Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Economist Corner, a CETA podcast where leading economists break down the latest news and policy updates. I'm Melinda Salento, Chief Executive of CETA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. Australia is great at research, but struggles to capture its commercial benefits. The World Intellectual Property Organization's 2020 Global Innovation Index ranks us 13th for innovation inputs, but 31st for innovation outputs. Bridging this gap is a growing focus for the government as part of its ambition to make Australia a leading digital economy by 2030. So what's holding us back? And how can we use Australian research to not only drive the economy, but also tackle social and environmental challenges? For insight on these questions, I spoke with CSIRO Chief Executive Dr. Larry Marshall and Microsoft Australia Managing Director Stephen Worrell. But first, I'm joined by CETA's Chief Economist, Jared Ball, to discuss some of the issues we're thinking about at CETA this week. Hi, Jared, how are you?
I'm good, Melinda. I'm very, very jealous of you, you know, driving the Economist Corner bus again this week and getting to talk to, Larry Marshall and Steve Worrell.
Yeah, look, I don't know what's going on, but I feel like I'm moving off the L plates and onto my P plates with this bus, Jared, so you better watch out.
Yeah, no, I'll be relegated to, having to be back on my P plates, I'm sure.
So one of the things that we've been talking a little bit about lately at CETA, but that's also coming up actually in conversations around the world amongst economists, is how well economies are transforming themselves coming out of the COVID pandemic. So lots of short-term stimulus, but not necessarily quite as much focus on policies that are really going to transform the economies for the future. And obviously innovation and research are a big part of that. This week, the IMD World Competitiveness Yearbook came out, which of course CETA participates in as a partner. What did that report tell us about how Australia's faring?
Well, I guess two distinct kind of findings. One, in the short term, you know, we got a good kind of grade for our economic performance and, you know, recovering, quite quickly from the COVID-induced economic shock. So a tick there. But on the longer term side, a whole bunch of things that, as you suggest, you know, around research, technology, things that are going to be really important to reigniting innovation and productivity and get us that longer term growth in jobs and incomes. We're falling down on a lot of those. So that led us to drop, out of the top 20 and into our lowest kind of ranking in 25 years in that survey. So that's a pretty big kind of finding. And really the areas where we fell down, management practice. So executives did not see really that Australian managers are taking as many risks or being as entrepreneurial as they might like. The sophistication of our export base, as we know, is very focused on, the Chinese market and very focused around resources. But also our technology infrastructure and our energy infrastructure, two, you know, really important areas for future growth.
Yeah, I think we've got, you know, we had two data points this week that are really interesting and hard to reconcile. So you're just sort of tracing through this, you know, quite significant drop really in our competitiveness rating. But then at the other side of the coin, the unemployment data came out this week, 5.1% jobs back above where they were pre-COVID. You know, how are you sort of making sense of this, this kind of two seemingly very different stories about what's going on in Australia?
Well, I think we also had Justin Wolfers during the week on a CETA live stream who, you know, talked about the V-shaped recovery as being simple arithmetic and that he couldn't believe that governments were patting themselves on the back so much in terms of achieving a V-shaped recovery, that when you close down your economy and then reopen it based on government advice, that is what will happen. And particularly if you throw a whole bunch of stimulus at it, that will also happen. So you've got those things happening in the short term, and there's no doubt the recovery in the labour market has just been remarkable. And another indicator that broadly the economy is kind of back to where it was pre-pandemic. But we haven't seen, you know, and we've had the productivity commissioner talk about this week around the fact that we have had that kind of low productivity growth in the last decade, and we haven't really changed anything structurally in terms of policy or in terms of really significant structural transformation in the economy. So I think that's the thing that we're all waiting to see, whether COVID might inspire a little more change in that respect. But it's hard to see that certainly in 2021 when we're still dealing with a lot of uncertainty around the pandemic.
So I just got to jump in here and say, obviously, there's been a lot on the CEDA stage this week on that's super relevant to the things that we talk about on this Economist Corner. I've got to go back to this one, Jared. So let me just paraphrase this. Justin Wolfe's view is, as an economist, that really government shouldn't be patting themselves on the back for getting employment back to where it was pre-pandemic after we faced a 1-in-100-year health crisis. Is that the sort of take on that? And what I mean that's
Well, and maybe I'm overstating it a little bit, because he did give Australia and certainly policymakers an A plus for their efforts in 2020. However, he gave policymakers a C minus in 2021, predominantly around the vaccine rollout. So perhaps I am overstating it a little bit, but he was quite critical of, you know, the credit that some governments were taking, I guess.
All right, Jared, I'm just going to close out that conversation now by saying I'm really glad that he is not one of the teachers at my kids' school, because I cannot imagine the conversations around the kitchen sink if they were getting those sorts of grades on the back of the economic performance we've seen in Australia. I can tell you that we're in my chat with Steve Worrell from Microsoft and Larry Marshall from the CSIRO, the IMD World Competitiveness stuff came up. And actually, Steve mentioned it as a sort of sign of why we need to do more in Australia around the types of things that Microsoft and CSIRO are doing in their partnership. So really interesting conversation around that, and maybe time we went and heard a little bit from them. Thanks a lot, Jared.
Thanks, Melinda.
Well, Stephen and Larry, thanks for joining us for another Economist Corner podcast at CEDA.
It's a great pleasure, Melinda.
We'll jump straight into the questions. Really interested to explore the partnership that Microsoft and CSIRO have set up. Perhaps, Stephen, starting with you. Last year, Microsoft and CSIRO did decide to set up a partnership to tackle a range of problems and problems that might not normally be associated with Microsoft, like illegal phishing and pollution. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Look, I think, Melinda, it came about largely as a realization that we think, and I know Larry agrees, that many of the greatest problems that we face here in Australia, and for that matter around the world, many of those problems will be found through using technology and science. And it's the intersection of science and technology that we feel can help to crack through some of those challenges. And obviously here in Australia, we have many. Over the last 18 months, the whole world's been dealing with the pandemic, and that's presented a series of other challenges, of course. But as we think about drought, we think about our natural ecosystem across the country, we think about decarbonisation of our economy and some of the other missions that Larry and the team are pursuing. I know Larry and I agree that there's an opportunity for us to use science and technology to great effect. And I think that's at the core of what the partnership was intended to address.
I have to say, it's literally music to my ears. I'm a huge believer in the important role that collaboration plays in working across sectors to tackle some of the so-called wicked problems that we face, but also to realise sort of, new opportunities. So it's not just about the challenges as much as, what we can make of those things and the opportunities. It was interesting when I was learning a little bit more about the partnership. I know people talk a lot about commercialization, and we will come back to that sort of concept. But this is almost some of the things you're talking about are almost a bit more like a socialization, aren't they? Of bringing tech and business and science together to tackle some problems that obviously have a financial aspect, but more a broader impact, if I can put it that way.
Oh, for sure. And I think that's part of the transition that we've seen in the tech industry over the last sort of decade or so. And I'm sure Larry will talk about the transitions that, are impacting his business in a moment. But no doubt, Melinda, in the tech industry, we've seen the evolution of what we now call cloud computing, which has simply meant that access to these hyperscale platforms is now ubiquitous. And we're now putting the power of what formerly would have been in a massive data center years ago and perhaps only available to the largest users of technology on the planet. We're now putting the power of that sort of capability with all sorts of new innovations around artificial intelligence and machine learning into the hands of each and every citizen across the country and around the world. And as a result, we often talk about this new wave of citizen development, right, where you're finding individual members of our community, and certainly this applies to some of the projects we've worked on with Larry's team up in the Northern Territory, where you've got individual members of my team or Larry's team working together with technology that's very advanced and provides this awesome capability but readily available and easily deployable. And then if you think about taking that technology and that capability and then inserting it into the hands of Indigenous park rangers, for argument's sake, you can make these massive breakthroughs. And so that's what we're most excited about, is just the illustration of how technology has evolved and the enormous range of opportunity that's now available to all of us.
Yeah, no, it is super exciting. Larry, interested in your perspective from the CSIRO around, what the partnership has enabled you to achieve that maybe you might not have thought possible.
Yeah, so for science to become relevant, you have to put it in the hands of real businesses and companies. And whenever we can do that with an existing company, especially a big one like Microsoft, that's our preference because it gets it to market much quicker. The thing that's different about this partnership, though, is it's we're actually co-inventing these solutions. So we've together discovered ways to deploy technology that neither one of us would have done on our own. And that's delivered some really amazing early wins, which have spurred us on to want to do even bigger things together.
Yeah, I can absolutely imagine that. Now, but let me ask a bit more of a challenging question. I mean, I think one of the things when we hear about different organisations like the CSIRO and Microsoft working together or universities working with business is the sort of the cultural challenges or the differences in the organisation that can impede progress. Perhaps a question to both of you, maybe starting with you, Stephen, around, how have you found working together? Have there been things that were expected or unexpected barriers to progress? What's your reflection on all of that?
I think we've learnt so much. And so there's no question there's an evolution that you go through in building the relationship. And as Larry's just said, we're just getting started. And some of the things that we've achieved so far, we're very proud of them. We know all the work is ahead of us. But I think there's a great learning curve that both sides go through, or both teams go through, which means from my side, our team is now starting to appreciate a little more the depth of the work that Larry's team are doing in the country. The important work they're doing in support of the six missions that the Prime Minister has bequeathed to Larry and the team to go and pursue on our behalf. And so simply understanding where the priorities are and specifically how science in Australia is leading the effort to address those missions, I think that's obviously a very basic starting point. But not surprisingly, we find members of our team have different passions. They might be interested in sustainability, or they might be interested in protecting the habitat or taking plastics out of our waterways. There are so many passions for members of our team. And as we start to join the dots between members of Larry's team with mine, you start to see this proliferation of ideas, and it starts to build momentum on top of the early successes we've had. So we're really bullish about what we can achieve in future. But as I say, we know there's a whole lot more work ahead of us.
And Larry, any interesting learnings from your perspective?
Yeah, so it's always hard for two large enterprises to work together. And SIRO, Microsoft is massive. SIRO is almost 10,000 people and 57 locations, but we're still not as big as Microsoft. But the challenge of navigating both organisations kind of gets in the way, the complexity. But Steve and I think have both learned you can cut through that by, as leaders, as CEOs, really leaning in. So we attend not all the meetings, but many of the meetings to show our teams that we're really serious about this. So leadership and then real clarity about the priorities. And that's why the missions coming out of our early work together. You know, we kind of did the small projects, not bigger than baby steps, but the small steps kind of figure out, you know, how to actually engage. And then we got really inspired to go harder and do these missions. So when you talk to Steve's team, they're passionate about eliminating plastic waste, about helping get towards net zero, and really passionate about helping other enterprises figure out how to map their climate risk. That's the Climate Resilient Enterprise mission. So once we harnessed their passions and earned a bit of trust and showed serious leadership, I think we were able to cut through a lot of the usual teething problems that two large organizations have when they work together.
And what about IP and sharing IP? I mean, how do the two organizations approach that? Because that's obviously something that comes up as a bit of a sticking point from time to time when you're talking about these sorts of collaborations.
Yeah, but to be fair, it's kind of obvious to us. I mean, anything that Microsoft can commercialize, they should, because they're going to be better at it than we are. And anything that they can't, which is maybe stuff that's more on the environmental side or more on the unusual hardware side, we might do it, or we'd figure out how to do it together, or we might go to a third party. But for us, the rule is whoever is in the best position to commercialize should be the one to do it. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, that seems pretty straightforward, but in other conversations, it seems to be more of a sticking point. Is that just because your organizations are similar enough but understand their own sort of comparative strengths?
Well, we're not a software company, so that helps.
Yeah. Similar in values or intent, I guess is what I should have said.
And actually, Steve, I guess technically you're much more than a software company now, aren't you?
That's true. I mean, yes, we are. So cloud services and the evolution of that, you know, that category, I think, is a better definition for us to use. But I think your point's well made, Larry, and to your question, Melinda, that what we've seen so far is this coming together of our teams in collaborative ways, where we've both got capabilities and skills that are instrumental to the outcome that we've ultimately been able to achieve. And I think fair to say, Melinda, as the relationship unfolds and perhaps as we get involved in more complex scenarios, I'm sure the conversation will come up more often than it has to this point, which has been very, very rarely. So I won't suggest that it's not a conversation that we won't be having, but I think the principles we've used to this point, as Larry's outlined, have been very effective and have served us well.
Oh, look, and you know, I think it's a fantastic example, and really, you know, more power to others in trying to adopt that approach. I mean, in other conversations I've had with people, it seems to become a sticking point. And you sort of, when you look back on the outcomes that came from it, I think the clarity that Larry articulated around, you know, if you start from the perspective of absolutely wanting to make the decision that maximises the probability of commercialisation, that's a starting point. But I think sometimes what you hear more frequently is people anticipating what the benefits of all of that commercialization will be, and they start sort of having a bit of a fight about that before they've actually figured out whether it's really going to be commercialized. Anyway, that's maybe perhaps a bit of a trite summary, but
no, I think it's very, very true. And maybe a couple other quick thoughts. One of the first collaborations was in the Northern Territory, where we were working with park rangers to use artificial intelligence and some basic drone capability to map the progression of a particular noxious weed that we could then direct the park rangers to go and remove from that section of the park. That code base and the capability that we built there, we then made open source. And I think in a way, you know, this is a particular example, of course, but when you're working in areas that are for the national interest and areas that really matter to us as a company, and quite obviously matter to CSIRO and matter to Australia, then the question of IP becomes secondary in regards to then we want to proliferate those sorts of opportunities for everyone. And so I think that's also been part of the relationship to date. And then the other thought, Melinda, that's important is that one of the first conversations I had with Larry that really got my attention was the description of the relationship that CSIRO have had with Boeing for more than 30 years. And you know, I won't go into detail here on it, but it is a wonderful relationship over 30 years. And I forget how many tens of millions of dollars and how many jobs have been created in Australia, Larry. But it's just a wonderful example of our National Science Agency plugging into a leader in a particular industry and leveraging our great strengths as a nation and quite obviously our wonderful science agency and all of its capabilities to better the lives of Australians by creating jobs here, by innovating here and clearly furthering our national interests in collaboration with a global organisation. So this story isn't about Boeing, it's about our National Science Agency's ability to team with others to do things that matter for the country.
And that's a fantastic point and a really good stepping off to my next question, if I can use it that way, because, I think, Larry, one of the I think it's this example with Microsoft, the example that Stephen was just talking about with Boeing, these are tremendous results and collaborations for Australia. How do we do more of this, through your organisation, but more broadly? How can we take the learnings of this exercise and partnership and actually turbocharge innovation and solutions to wicked problems more broadly?
Yeah, so our approach to this, and it goes back actually more than 50 years to the mission with NASA. And in fact, if I go back 100 years, CSIRO was created for the mission to eradicate prickly pear, and then later did the mission to deal with the rabbit plague using myxomatosis, inventing that. So I think missions are the key, and our 100-year history tells us that. It's certainly amazing to me to see how inspired Steve's people have become with the notion of co-creating some of these missions together and actually delivering them. And my hope with Microsoft specifically is that Steve will start to really deliver these unexpected benefits back to corporate headquarters, and that over time, corporate will realize that actually Australia is a pretty good place to invest to develop quite unusual and differentiated things. And that would be the Boeing story where, fast forward a few years, you've got 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people working for Microsoft here doing R&D and engineering and development for a global corporation. We need more of that, right? We so many of our people, smartest people, leave and go and work in other countries, and not many of them come back. So the more we can create those opportunities here, the better. And large companies like Microsoft and Boeing are really a key to that. The other great thing about Microsoft, it may surprise you. So some of the other things that I said earlier, when we can't find a company that could commercialize something already, then we invent a company. And we invented a company called V2 Foods that makes plant-based protein burgers for Hungry Jack's and Woolworths. We invented a hydrogen device, which Fortescue are commercializing, but it would surprise you that Microsoft, in particular Steve, has leaned in to find out what else can we do with that technology with hydrogen, and how else can we get other large companies to support the piloting of hydrogen projects. Why? Because Microsoft has a passion for net zero emissions, and as an enterprise globally has a dedicated plan for that. So That's something that you wouldn't think CSIRO and Microsoft would be working on a hydrogen device, but actually we are, because we're working together to get other companies to deploy it. And I'll be stunned if at some point Steve doesn't come up with some sort of artificial intelligence angle on hydrogen and zero, because he has brilliant people working for him. And that's what he said at the beginning, the intersection of breakthrough science and technology is the way we're going to create a better future.
Yeah. So Stephen, how do you feel about that aspiration? And, I think a little bit of a segue here, we released overnight was the IMD World Competitiveness Yearbook, which CEDA partners with IMD on. And it actually wasn't a super glowing perspective from business around the sorts of underlying factors or characteristics which would support the sort of outcomes that Larry was talking about. So how do you see Australia's potential, and is it likely that headquarters would look over and go, yeah, here's a great place to be really trying to invest and grow some spectacular opportunities?
Well, that's my role. I'm an Australian first, and I'm the MD at Microsoft second. My job, I think, is to advocate for my country, and that's exactly what I want to do in terms of this partnership, which is to highlight the ingenuity and the capabilities that we have as a nation. We all know we have so much capacity to grow and innovate, and yet we know the need for that, Melinda, as you just highlighted yet again with this latest competitiveness report, is more urgent than ever. If you go back a couple of years, we came into the pandemic with 13 million Australians in our workforce, and happily we're now back to that level now, which is great. But we also know prior to the pandemic, there was an expectation that many millions of jobs would be disrupted through automation and the rise of technology. We know we need to create millions of new jobs in new parts of our economy as our economy transitions away from our heritage to whatever the future might hold. And I'm not suggesting that the Microsoft CSIRO partnership is the answer to that challenge, but it's got to be part of it, right? I think it's where business and government work more closely together to create new ways of doing business, new improvements that help to create we decarbonize our economy, for argument's sake, or we better manage our environment, or many other ways in which we know technology and science can help. That is going to create new jobs. It's going to create new opportunities for a small and medium business to explore those intersections and I expect create the new jobs of the future.
And are there any particular sort of policy levers or settings that you would sort of put on the top of your wish list for attention to sort of make that, a greater prospect, if you like? And, I know if I go back to the federal budget, there were some initiatives contained there, including things like the patent box and, more attention to a digital economy strategy. Are we doing enough in that space, or are there particular things that you think might be beneficial?
Oh, look, I think there's always things to be done, but to be fair, I think the tech industry has been banging the drum around R&D and visas and so forth for many years. And I think, to be fair to the government, there's been changes made, including in the patent box that you've mentioned, which comes into effect next year, and also the tweaking of the R&D policy. So my answer to the question, I think, Melinda, is more in relation to how government and business come together to address perhaps the single biggest threat to what we're talking about, which is the lack of skills that we have here in the country. Now, ironically, these challenges, the opportunity and the challenges is linked to the extent that we're talking about creating lots of new high-paying jobs in new industries in Australia. We know we're going to need them because there'll be many people moving out of industries as they transition. But we need a more consolidated and a more aligned plan between business and government to help upskill and reskill many hundreds of thousands of Australians as they move from one industry to another. And I think that's where I'd be and am focusing my efforts in my conversations with government.
Yeah, certainly very consistent as well with some of the issues on CEDA's agenda. We're obviously pretty focused on the issue of immigration and skilled migration, but sitting alongside that, as you rightly point out, has got to be an equally serious conversation around building up our own skills base within Australia, for people who are living here now. But to Larry's point too, it'd be nice to attract back a few of the diaspora. I know, yes, a lot of them have come back for the pandemic and some are planning on staying, but when interesting opportunities beckon overseas, it's of course they're going to head to those opportunities. I think that sort of talent is drawn to wherever, the most exciting opportunities are. So the more of those we can create in Australia through partnerships like the one we've just been talking, the better, I think.
Well, I agree. Maybe a quick other thought. There's a global digital supply chain in operation around the world, quite obviously. And there are some key players that operate in and around that supply chain. Microsoft is one. The extent to which you can plug into that digital supply chain and also recognize something that's been made very, very clear to us all over the last 18 months, and that is you can work from anywhere, right? I think if we didn't realize that prior to the pandemic, I think we've now understood that more clearly. Why not? Why can't we create the sorts of roles here and the industries here that perhaps might otherwise be on the east coast of China or the west coast of the US.
Larry, I think you were going to jump in with some thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, look, I just really wanted to amplify your point about our own people, because we lose, like, if you look at kids, they come in equally with a love of science, but between year four and year eight, we lose half the girls in science and maths, and we can't afford to do that. Now, we lose, you know, both of them continually through the process until we get to uni. But losing half the girls at such a young age is just, that's bad for the country, and we've got to figure out how to crack that. And in terms of what the government can do about it, there's a few really interesting levers in the budget, I thought. So the $1.2 billion for the digital economy strategy, the $50 million for the National Artificial Intelligence Center, which we'll have the obligation to create as the National Science Agency, the technology investment roadmap, $1.6 billion for the development of low emissions technologies, and the $209 million for the Australian Climate Service. Steve and I are both excited about a number of those because they feed directly into the missions that we're working on and our ability to deliver real solutions to some of those most compelling problems, not just for Australia, but for the world.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a really nice point to finish off on. I think we're CETA's well behind the sort of partnership that your two organisations have set up. I think there's so much potential in this country and so much that we can do to tackle challenges, as I said earlier, but also to just create some fantastic new opportunities. And I love the fact that we can talk about them as positively as we have in this podcast. And, I'd like to see us do more about it, you know, because I think so often people look at examples in the rest of the world, yet there's some just great things happening here in our own backyard. Stephen and...
We ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah, good. Excellent. Well, you know, you both of you have a standing invitation to jump back into our podcast and tell us more, because I just think the more we talk about it and the more we talk about how different sectors can collaborate, the more we'll open people's eyes and aspiration, if I can put it that way. And I really share your enthusiasm, Larry. Well, thank you to both of you. That was CSIRO Chief Executive Dr. Larry Marshall and Microsoft Australia Managing Director Stephen Worrell. I'm Linda Salento, Chief Executive of CETA. I hope you found that both interesting and inspiring. If you want to hear more of our CETA podcasts, you can subscribe to them using your favourite podcasting app. Thanks so much for listening.